Nearly 40% of all the water taken from lakes, rivers, and wells in the United States isn't used for agriculture, drinking, or even sanitation. It's used to cool power plants that produce electricity by burning fossil fuels, or in a few cases, in nuclear reactors. 2/3 of these power plants use evaporative cooling, which produces huge white plumes billowing from the cooling towers going into the air. A new company using technology developed by MIT has the goal of reducing the water needs of power plants and helping to alleviate water shortages in areas where power plants strain the capacity of the local water systems. This new technology is relatively simple in principle, but developing it to the point where it can be applied at full scale at industrial power plants is a little bit of a greater challenge. The basic idea is to capture water droplets from both natural fog and from the plumes that the power plant cooling towers produce. The MIT researchers had to improve the efficiency of the fog harvesting systems, they call them, which previously captured only 2 or 3% of the water droplets that passed through them. They found that water vapor collection could be made much more efficient by zapping the tiny droplets of water with just a little ion beam, giving them a slight electric charge, thereby making them much easier to capture with the metal mesh of what they call their harvesting system. The system can essentially eliminate cooling tower plumes and produce large quantities of high purity water in the process, which has uses at many of the power plants. The new company called Infinite Cooling has arranged to install their equipment on 2 operating commercial power plants this year. They expect the system to reduce the overall needs of water by at least 20%. Now let's add a few more facts. This is sort of my factoid part, organic matters factoids. One of them that's kind of gotten me because I've been in this over a decade or two just talking about this, and that is, I'm going to try to give you a few of what I call electric vehicle myths that we're going to kind of bust, that people either believe are true or they think are true that probably aren't. From the early days of hybrid vehicles right on through current booming market, and it is booming right now for electric cars, there's been the contention by some people that these cars are responsible for comparable or even greater amounts of greenhouse gas emissions over their product lifetime. The arguments generally are centered around the carbon cost of creating batteries for the cars, as well as the emissions associated with generating the electricity used to charge them. However, a new study published by the International Council for Clean Transportation reports a life cycle assessment that considers every source of carbon generated from the cradle to the grave of the vehicle. Included in the assessment are the mining cost of the lithium to make the batteries, the transportation of batteries across the world, literally, by container ship, and the end-of-life burden. In other words, the mix of energy generation in various places around the world, and so on, where these batteries end up. The results of the analysis that are even in India and China, which are the biggest burners of coal on Earth, it still results in lower emissions to drive an EV instead of an internal combustion engine vehicle. Lifetime emissions of today's average medium-sized EVs are lower than comparable gas cars by 66 to 69%. That's a bunch, folks. That's in Europe. 60 to 68% in the United States, and up to even 45% in China, about 35% in India. As electricity generation continues to further decarbonize, all these numbers, of course, are only going to get better. While it is somewhat more carbon intensive to manufacture an EV, it doesn't take very long in the life of that car to come out ahead if you own one. Early skeptics of RVs and hybrids had more legitimate concerns a decade or so ago, but the advantages of these newest vehicles are now unambiguous. They work, folks, and they're going to get better. And this next little bit of information is something I've been waiting to be able to communicate. A combination of factors led to emissions from the United States power sector dropping a little over 10% between 2019 and 2020, which was the last one-year drop measured since annual reports first began back in 1997, as far as I can find. The coronavirus pandemic was certainly a contributing factor, but the drop in emissions is part of a long-term trend being driven by increasing reliance on renewable energy sources, diminishing use of coal, and overall improving energy efficiency. Between 2000 and 2020, power generations from solar, wind, and even geothermal generation more than doubled. Coupled with the declining use of coal power, power sector emissions during that period dropped by over 37%, even though the U.S. gross domestic product grew by 40% over that same number of years. Overall, at this point, zero carbon electricity sources, which include wind, solar, geothermal, hydropower, and to some degree nuclear power, provided about 38% of all the electricity here in the United States. And though I don't want to get political, thank goodness we have somebody back in the White House that understands this. The current administration has set a target of 100% zero carbon power by the year 2035. Given that the cost of wind and solar power continue to fall precipitously, I love the word, there are power companies pushing for setting an intermediate goal of at least 80% totally clean power by 2030. We're only running about 10 or 15 years late, folks. According to the recent research, the increasingly attractive cost of renewable power, along with the job creation associated, which means that it's reaching, listen to this, at least 90% clean power by the year 2035 could be achieved at basically no increase in cost to the average consumer. Being able to separate economic growth from emissions makes it far more likely that the goals of what we're looking for, called decarbonization, can be met without encountering economic resistance of any kind, which the oil companies and the other power companies have painted this false picture that this is not going to happen. Folks, it's not just not going to happen, it's already happening. Let's shift gears here for a minute. Let's talk about a few of the fall gardening tasks to make your garden either grow through the winter, but more importantly, really, really kind of sing for next spring. Probably the first thing you need to do is kind of doing an honest evaluation of your garden. What worked this year? What wouldn't you repeat if you had a choice? Do yourself a favor and start a list now that you can use when you shopped for next spring's garden. In general, fall is just a good time to kind of evaluate the things you did for the year and see if that was the best or are there better things you can do. Kind of think about this. Which plant should be moved to a better spot in the garden? Very, very unique last year, the weather was, so it's a good time to really do that. Where do you need more privacy or screening for your yard? Think about that as part of the gardening, not necessarily vegetable garden, but gardening in general. Where could you use more plants with fall color, fall interest? Because now is the perfect time to look at that. It's sort of a good time to think about removing annuals from your containers or your landscapes. A few of your plants may look really great in the fall, but once frost hits, you'll wish you'd pulled them sooner. Healthy annuals can be composted, but although I think anything can be composted done properly, it might be best if you have plants that you're questionable about, they might be diseased or whatever, you might want to just physically dispose of them. Do realize, though, that fall is for planting. Still warm soil and relatively cool air temperatures promote healthy root growth in plants that return every year, annuals. Take advantage of end-of-season sales on trees and shrubs at your local nurseries and divide or move perennials around. Ideally, give the roots at least 6 weeks to settle into their new home before the ground is really getting colder and some places up north actually freezes. And just a reminder here for a lot of us, just don't cut your perennials back in the fall. Some people think they should. Evergreen and semi-evergreen perennials like dianthus, pinks, coral bells, most of your phlox, bugleweed, which is Regia and Ajuga, and the red hot poker, which I love, should not be cut back. perennials with woody stems, like rose mallow, which is hibiscus, Russian sage, lavender, of course, butterfly bush, buddleia, which is a great butterfly bush, literally. Don't cut those back. Perennials that kind of are interesting in the winter, like false indigo, the genus is Batistia, coneflowers, echinacea, okay, and another of ornamental grasses like prairie winds, actually do best not cut. As is also true with some of the things we call stone crops, they're sedums usually, ornamental onions, alliums, okay, and a number of the Lenten roses called hellebores, all, again, are better off not cut in the fall. And some of us forget this. Remember to continue to water the garden. While it might look like the plants are just going to sleep, they're not doing anything, their roots are still actively growing in most parts of the country. Evergreen perennials, shrubs and trees, as well as anything you've recently planted, will need to be watered until the ground either freezes, if you're in that area, or if you live when the ground cools below the 50s or so. If you live in an area that receives abundant rain in the fall, you might not need to provide much supplement in the way of water. But if rainfall is less reliable, and it has been lately, be sure to try to remember every week or 10 days, I do about a week, a really deep watering. Don't water too often, but when you water, water deeply, give it a good soaking, and then leave it alone. Depending on the weather, if no rain comes or if the humidity is really low, then a little more often. But you just have to play it with nature. There is no, I can do this every week or every 4 days or every 10. You have to follow what's going on with the nature around you. And do realize that nature itself delivers natural mulch at our feet every year, okay? Finely textured leaves, willows and honey locusts, and those with smaller leaves don't really need to be raked or anything. Just leave them there. But some of the big leaf plants, some of the broad leaves like maples and sycamores and even some of the big oak leafed oaks, and they get matted down, and you might want to take them. I think the best investment for a person with a good mower is a mulching blade. Mulch them and still leave them lay, or if you need to, mulch them and then gather them back up and put them in your own flower beds or your own gardens. It's good for the soil. Why are you taking organic material, bagging it up, sending it away, and then going to buy more organic material? It just really doesn't make sense. So that was just a few little hints. I just kind of off the top of my head about fall and winter that's coming. It's time, and you can actually be an asset to your gardening and your lawns instead of a liability.